With our special guest this hour, Paul Halpern. His book is The Quantum Labyrinth. We're going to be back with your calls as we continue this discussion about physics and the universe next on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Paul Halpern, his book, The Quantum Labyrinth. Paul, assuming you could go through a wormhole, what do you think is on the other side of it? What does it connect to?
Well, so we don't really know what would be on the other side. I mean, hypothetically, it would be connected to another part of space. But is it a part of space that we would have access to otherwise? We really don't know. Could it be another part of the universe or part of our universe, different universe? It's all very hypothetical. One of the interesting things about wormholes, though, is that according to Kip Thorne and his colleagues, if you could accelerate one of the entrances, you could slow down time in that region, and you could travel through the wormhole and go backward in time, which is one of the interesting things. And for some people say, well, that actually rules out wormholes, because as everybody knows, according to this trend of thought, we can't go back in time. And then other people say, well, if you could go back in time, as long as you didn't disrupt the past, as long as everything's self-consistent, then everything would be fine, and that you wouldn't destroy the fabric of cause and effect. So there was a debate in the pages of very serious physics journals in the late 80s and 1990s about whether or not, if you have a wormhole, if you go through it and could go back in time, whether or not you could do so in a way that's consistent with reality, or whether it's completely ruled out by physics, the laws of physics.
Some people believe if you go through a wormhole, you get torn to shreds.
Well, that would be certainly, if you went through a black hole, you'd be torn to shreds. The wormholes that Kip Thorne was talking about were ones that were tailor-made or custom-made, perhaps by an advanced civilization, so that the forces on you as you went through wouldn't be strong enough to tear you apart.
And what's the difference between a wormhole and a black hole?
Well, the original idea of black holes was if you have a collapsed star and the star collapses and it becomes an incredibly dense region, and it's so dense that it basically distorts space and time and creates kind of a gap or a hole in space-time. And then later, people looked at the solution mathematically and said, well, this hole could be connected to another part of the universe. So a hole can't really go to nothing, so it has to be connected to somewhere. And this was just a mathematical construct, and that's what became the original idea of wormholes. And then, but of course, those kinds of wormholes, the original kind, were not something you could travel through without being torn to shreds. You'd be, as physicists say, spaghettified. You'd be stretched out in one direction and compressed in another direction. So it wouldn't be very pleasant. So no one would really want to do this. But that's when Kip Thorne and others said, well, what if we could custom make these objects in a way that they are traversable, that they are safe? So it's almost like reverse engineering, saying, we want something that works in a way that you could travel through it. Let's reverse engineer it so that instead of being crushed, you wouldn't be crushed. Well, the only problem is it requires a certain kind of matter, which is of negative mass. And nobody has ever found any matter of negative mass. So that's a little bit of a catch there.
Did you see the movie Contact based on Carl Sagan's book?
Yes, I did, with Jodie Foster.
Yeah. What did those were wormholes that she was going through to get to that other planetary system, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of the product of all this research, that Kip Thorne gave this information to Carl Sagan, and Carl Sagan used it in his book, and then it was later used in the movie. So a lot of stuff in science eventually ends up as science fiction, and then sometimes that science fiction inspires more science.
Do you think one day we will be able to develop a time machine and go forward and backwards?
Well, interestingly, forward is relatively easy in physics, because according to Einstein's special theory of relativity, if you travel close enough to the speed of light, your internal clock slows down. So all you would have to do, and this is hypothetical for humans because we haven't traveled this fast, but if you could travel 99.999% of the speed of light in a spaceship, then your clock would slow down compared to everybody else. And when you return to Earth, everybody would be much older, let's say 100 years older, and you would have only aged, say, 1 year. And you'll come back and everybody, all your friends and family members will be either gone or extremely old, and you'll seem like you've just gone away, you know, briefly. And that is something that all physicists believe in, because we've done that with particles. We've taken particles that decay very quickly and accelerated them close to the speed of light, and then all of a sudden they're much longer living particles. So we've created sort of eternal youth, so to speak, in the particle world, but particles are so much lighter than people that it's much easier to accelerate them to high speeds. It's very hard to accelerate a person to close to the speed of light. We haven't come anywhere near close to that.
If for some reason, let's say mankind survives 500 more years, do you think that in that year that it's conceivable to have time travel 500 years from now?
Well, I think, once again, there's a difference between the forward and backward time travel.
Right.
No one has really shown that backward time travel is possible. It's just a hypothetical. And forward time travel, if we continue to push space travel forward and we get faster and faster and we develop new kinds of space drives, I think forward time travel will be possible. Because we've done it to a very limited extent with high-speed flights. We've had these very, very sensitive clocks and put them up on high-speed aircraft. And these sensitive clocks show that time is different once you're going closer to the speed of light. So this has been done only very, very subtly. So when astronauts go up, they age very, very slightly less than people on Earth because they're traveling so fast. But it's in the nanoseconds. It's not something
right.
that really makes a big difference in their lives.
They're not going to come back like Benjamin Button or anything like that.
That's right, but maybe 500 years from now, space travel will be something more common, and certainly if there's interstellar travel, we might start seeing these effects more seriously.
Okay, yeah. Let's go to the phones for you. You ready?
Yes.
West of the Rockies, Jack in San Diego, California is with us. Hey, Jack, welcome to the show.
So, I've got a question for the guest.
All right.
Is size or, let's say, mass, is it relative? In other words, here's a hypothetical. Let's say right now we're being visited by a very advanced, intelligent life form, but we judge everything by our scale. And let's say they're so small that it's microscopic, and we don't see it.
We don't see them at all. Smaller than ants, even.
Well, that's an interesting question, but if we look at quantum physics and our understanding of life, there are certain lower limits. We couldn't really, for example, despite science fiction saying that you could have a shrink gun, if you tried to shrink a person down, the only way you could do it would be either removing cells in which they would become a simple life form, they wouldn't be a person, or trying to shrink down the atoms of a person. But atoms have a certain minimum size, and quantum physics shows that the atoms really can't be shrunk down and still be atoms. So it would not only have to be a completely different life form, it would have to be completely different laws of physics, which, you know, I don't really think is possible for something like that to happen. So to make a long story short, I don't think that there could be microscopic creatures with the same kind of intelligence or advanced life that humans have.
Well, probably not. Do you believe that there is extraterrestrial life out there, Paul?
I think given the vastness of the universe and given the fact that we've found so many planets out there, I think there must be some kind of extraterrestrial life. I don't personally believe that there's any evidence on Earth of any visitation by extraterrestrial life in the past, but it could be that somewhere on some planet out there, such intelligent life, or even, you know, more commonly, you know, primitive life could exist in other planets that we haven't detected yet or haven't seen yet. And that's why it's so important that we observe other planets and we try to look for signs, for example, of oxygen in the atmosphere, water in the atmosphere, and try to hunt for planets that might possibly have other life forms.
Next up, let's go to Roger in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Raj, go ahead.
Yes, hi, guys. I have a thought that is kind of mind-blowing. What about this? Reality is a spectrum of multiverses ranging from heaven to hell, where reincarnation is travel between multiverses because of the law of entropy and all matter decays. The future, the ultimate future, is the quantum level, and the ultimate past is the Big Bang level, and of course the Big Bang level being hot is hell, and the quantum level being all things possible is heaven, where all wishes come true, and our souls are just singularities of intention, so that based upon our free will choices, our moral development, we reincarnated to more perfect or less perfect multiverses.
Paul, did you follow that? You got to be a physicist to do this.
Well, that's kind of an interesting scheme, or an interesting sort of way of imagining heaven and hell. But in my opinion, as a scientist, I'm not a theologian, and I think that science is looking at what happens here on Earth or in space, but scientists can't really look at what happens after death. That's something that either there's nothing after death, or if there is something, science really can't address it. It's something that is addressed by the world's religions.
Back to Wheeler and Feynman, when they first got together, one was the assistant to the other in college, right?
Yeah, so Feynman was a graduate student of Wheeler and just got randomly assigned to, by chance, to work with Wheeler. And it was a really amazing combination, because Wheeler was very conservative in appearance. He was very soft-spoken. He always wore a suit and tie. He was very quiet, dry sense of humor. But he was the one with the wild ideas. He was the one who would think about the universe, to think about what's out there. And Feynman was a much more wild person. He later in life would play bongo drums all the time. He went to different bars. He had a kind of a very raucous life. He would pick up hitchhikers on the highway and all this stuff. When he lived in Southern California, lived in Altadena for a while, he had friends who were very bohemian, an artist who lives on a ranch, who was kind of a wild artist. But at the same time, Feynman, in his physics, he was very conservative. He wanted only to do things that are testable, provable. He didn't really like philosophy. He didn't want to speculate. But together, Feynman and Wheeler were a perfect combination, because Wheeler would come up with the zany ideas and Feynman would come up with the more solid theories that he could test. And Feynman, of course, got the Nobel Prize for that.
Feynman died at 70 of cancer, but Wheeler went into his 90s, didn't he?
Yeah, I got the opportunity to meet him when he was in his 90s, and he was still going into his office when he was 91, 92.
Wow.
He would come in. And
good for him.
Lives in a retirement home and still coming up with these wild ideas. And he was trying to answer the ultimate question in his 90s, how come existence? He was trying to think of the meaning of existence.
That's a question we're all asking ourselves all the time, Paul. You know it?
Yes, that's right. So,
how did Wheeler, it start? Wheeler, what's it mean?
Yeah, Wheeler was a very remarkable person and, really very far-reaching person, a real visionary.
Let's go to Thomas in La Jolla, California now. Hey, Thomas, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. Paul, my question is about another figure in physics at the same time, Dirac. Dias and David, IRAC. What role did Dirac play in the evolution of physics? And he was about the same time as Wheeler and Feynman, etc.
That's a very interesting question. In fact, in my book, I show how Dirac tried to come up with a law explaining how electrons interact with each other, and he came up with papers and a book, but then he kind of reached a limit, and he did a calculation in his book, and the answer was infinity, just like taking a calculator and dividing one by zero and getting undefined. And Dirac said, well, this is a mystery. I can't really explain it. And that's where Feynman saw his chance to make his mark in physics, because he took that mystery and came up with this idea of sum over histories and other techniques to try to understand how particles interact. So Dirac was a real giant in his time, and Feynman was seen kind of as the next Dirac, because Feynman moved beyond Dirac and came up with a way to understand quantum physics that didn't give, you know, an answer infinity. He got reasonable answers in his calculations.
Were these people competitive in that era?
Yes, they were. When Feynman was developing his ideas, there was somebody else named Julian Schwinger, who was much more mathematical, much more rigorous, and so forth. And Schwinger saw his techniques as being superior, and Feynman was much more, seemed much more haphazard. He would seemed like he was throwing things together, even though he was brilliant. Feynman liked doing things in a way that seemed kind of mysterious, magical, coming up with an answer using what seemed like tricks, even though it was really, really good mathematics, but it seemed like a trick. And Schwinger liked to prove everything. But both of them, and then a Japanese physicist named Tomonaga, who also worked on these ideas, came up with really the same, what was shown to be an equivalent technique. So all three of them won the Nobel Prize in 1965.
How influential was the German physicist Heisenberg?
Well, Heisenberg was certainly very influential, especially in the 1920s, with his idea of the uncertainty principle, that if you try to measure the position and velocity of a particle at the same time, you can't do both. You can only measure one at a time. The other one is hazy. So Heisenberg was around at this time, but of course during World War II, Feynman, Wheeler, and Heisenberg played radically different roles.
Right.
Heisenberg was working for the Germans, the German side, and Wheeler and Feynman were working for the American side.
Were they, at least in terms of what they did they contribute to the war effort?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Feynman and Wheeler were both involved in the atomic bomb design.
Oh, they were? Okay.
Yeah.
They were with Oppenheimer.
Yeah. In fact, Feynman worked under Oppenheimer and Hans Bethe at Los Alamos. And Wheeler worked on plutonium, making plutonium. And after the bomb, Wheeler and Feynman had different attitudes about the atomic bomb. Feynman ultimately thought it was a mistake to do that. He thought we needed to do that to compete with the Germans, but once we found out the Germans weren't working on their own bomb, we should have just stopped.
Right.
And Wheeler, whose brother died, his younger brother died in the war, thought that the bomb should have been rushed and developed a couple years earlier, and maybe millions of lives would have been
saved. And that's always been that theory, too. We're going to come back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the next hour, we're going to talk about some bizarre stories. Make sure you're part of the program, but we're going to come back in a moment with Paul Halpern to talk more about the quantum labyrinth. Welcome back. Paul, what got you into the physics field? How did that happen?
Well, as a child, I really liked going to science museums, and I would just go up to displays, push the buttons, and see what happens. See sparks go off and all sorts of things. And then when I was in high school, my dad took me to a physics class, and, you know, it was just in a library, and I was really fascinated by the particle world and decided to become a physicist. And I still, enjoy doing physics calculations, but also explaining physics to the general public and exploring the history of physics.
Well, we're all the better for it, that's for sure. And are you still a physics instructor in Philadelphia?
I am a physics professor, and I teach students and write books, work on articles, work on blog posts, all sorts of things to try to get the word out about physics and its exalted history.
Paul Halpern with us. His book is The Quantum Labyrinth, and it's available on Amazon and bookstores too, Paul?
Yes, it's available bookstores around the country and various online sites.
Dark matter, how do you explain that?
Well, that is one of the big mysteries in science. When you ask me about what mysteries I would like explained, not only higher dimensions, whether or not they exist, but also what's the missing substance out there that is keeping galaxies together? Because if you don't have dark matter, you can't really explain how galaxies stick together. There's just not enough visible material in galaxies. They would be unstable. They would fall apart. And yet there's something out there, but we really don't know what it is. And despite trying to measure particles on Earth and trying to see if there's some substance that could explain it, scientists have still fallen short to try to explain what the dark matter particles are. And dark energy is the other big mystery. That's something that's pushing the galaxies apart faster and faster, but we really don't know what that is either.
All right. Well, let's go back to more calls. Randy is in Lubbock, Texas, first-time caller. Hey, Randy, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Let me preface this with something. This came to me in a dream by two men. I had to listen to hours of dialect to figure out one had an Austrian accent and one had an Italian accent.
Okay.
Okay. They showed me in this dream a large ring, kind of like electromagnetic ring, almost like the Japanese use for rail travel. Now, my sons and I have built our own version of rail guns to shoot ball bearings at stray cats and things.
Mm-hmm.
So we built a small one of these, okay? What I used was charged ball bearings on a stainless steel ring. And in this dream, they showed me this big, huge one that the ring on the outside, you use the ball bearings to actually create a magnetic field as it's traveling, just like a Japanese rail does. We built a smaller version of this using a DC generator out of an arc welder. And then in the dream, they showed me, and I'm saying it's a dream, but this is it actually worked to a point, that I needed a high voltage charge in the center. So once we built this smaller version, it was great. It was almost magnificent, the sound that was coming out of it. It was like a bad acid trip almost. But we used a solid wire to introduce a high voltage charge in it. And when we did, inside of this ring became a glowing blue sphere. And inside this glowing blue sphere, it was almost like you were looking at the Hubble telescope looking into the atmosphere or looking into the cosmos.
Sounded like you were creating your own mini universe with that. Strange things happen in dreams, Paul.
Yes, that's true. We can really come up with new ideas in dreams sometimes. And like I heard you mention Tesla before. Tesla was certainly somebody who was often coming up with ideas and very imaginative persons. And you know, there've been geniuses at different points in history who, in their dreams or in their just thinking about things, come up with inventions that have been very marvelous.
Has that ever happened to you, where you got some revelation in a dream?
I wish I did come up with inventions in dreams. What does happen to me, since I'm a science writer, is I'll wake up with some idea for how to explain something, and then I try to write it down as quickly as possible, and so that I can use it for one of my books or one of my articles. So I think I have not just a science side, but a literary side too. And sometimes that comes out in dreams, that, you know, coming up with imaginative ways to explain things rather than new inventions.
Let's go out to Washington, Iowa. Tony's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Tony, go ahead.
Oh, yes. Hello.
Hi,
George.
Tony.
I got to tell you, what a great job you do. you sound really meek, and let me tell you, if we're headed for hard times, you're headed for a good place if you are what you sound like on the air. So,
well, we're going to carry people with us.
My question was for the gentleman, Mr. Halpern. I was thinking of, you know, the equation E equals MC squared. What if energy itself had a shape? What if there was intelligent life on the other side of the equation? Wouldn't that explain a lot of the phenomena that we experience that is quite unexplainable?
Well,
quantum question for you, Paul.
So energy could be, energy can be really any kind of energy. And, you know, we're talking about if energy had a shape. That's one thing that Wheeler was considering, is if you could take space itself and curve it around or twist it around, that the attraction of space to itself, the gravitational energy, would also fit into the equation E equals mc squared, and perhaps you could create a mass or create matter that way. And that was one of Wheeler's ideas. He called it a geon, which is a gravitational object that just exists in empty space, but has energy and then therefore has the equivalent of mass. And he was hoping to explain particles that way, but it never quite worked out.
Next up, we go to Henry in Los Angeles. Hello, Henry. Welcome to the program.
Hey, fellas. How are you guys doing tonight?
Okay, Henry.
So just want to explain two quick things, one about science and then the other one bridging the gap between two sources. So real quick, in science we have one. Sorry, I'm at work a little bit out of breath.
Oh, that's all right. What do you do?
I do maintenance service on clinics and warehouses and stuff like that.
All right. Just take a little deep breath and we're for you.
Okay, and I'm a little excited too.
Okay.
Coast to coast, by the way. So we have evolution, and that's what we see, physical growth. But we also have to be aware that there's spiritual evolution, and we could see proof for the physical evolution by looking like at the finches in the Galapagos Islands, right? And then we have the spiritual evolution, which is like when the caveman era, they all around the world at the same time, they got the awareness that they could make art, and they started going into caves and drawing horses and stuff like that. So that's the evolution we have. And in the scientific field, that's where we're growing spiritually. That's the growth of our awareness. Like in the 1400s, we had the geocentric system, which is like the world being in the middle and everything revolves around the world, right? But then Copernicus questioned it, and then Galileo proved they're correct, which brought in the heliocentric system, which shows that we as humans can be wrong. Science can be wrong. Like Einstein, he developed the laws of relativity, which explains so much. But now we're going into another rabbit hole, and that's the quantum field. So your guess, he said that we have to separate science and what do you want to call it, like spirituality or whatever. But I feel we have to bridge the gap between those two so we could have a better outcome. And if we do bridge science and spirituality, like using the quantum field, which I have so much love for the quantum field, it helped me understand so much. And on the quantum field, we have this thing called omniscience.
Okay, I'm gonna slow you down here, Henry. I need you to ask a question.
I just want to explain it to him. This omniscient, it shows that other source, it has complete knowing, and omnipresence, it shows that it's entangled. Like he said, Wilmer, he was baffled by entanglement. Well, that shows that higher source is entangled with me, you, George, and everyone. And then omnipotent, it shows that it is possible for a higher source to be possible, because if we use the laws of probability and the quantum field, it literally, a scientist could calculate me jumping through a wall.
All right, you're out of my pay grade. I don't know. Do you follow it, Paul?
Well, I think when I said that in terms of separating science and spirituality, I'm not saying that a scientist can't be a spiritual person. And there were very well-known scientists like Georges Lemaître, who was one of the founders of the Big Bang Theory, who was an abbé, a Belgian abbé, and he was a very spiritual person. But when he talked about the Big Bang Theory, he would never bring religion into it. He would say, well, these are the equations, this is why I believe in this, and through proof, and he saw Hubble's observations of galaxies as a proof of his theory. So you can be, I think, a spiritual person or a religious person and engage in science. What I'm saying is, when you make a scientific speculation, it needs to be tested through scientific methods. And spirituality is an internal thing that one, you know, in a way it's a dialogue one is having, an inner dialogue with oneself, and trying to figure out the purpose of one's own life, or what one wants to do with one's own life. And that is certainly valid. It's just not part of the scientific method.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I always ask scientists this question. Do you believe in the so-called God theory?
So I consider myself not a religious person, but I try to look for answers internally. I consider myself a spiritual person, but not a religious person. And I don't believe in anything which is written down or ordained in a holy text or in something that's been passed down. But I think that everybody needs to kind of think to themselves and wonder why they're out there, what is the purpose of their life. And I think that that to be completely materialistic and just to think only about science and not think about purpose or one's own philosophy, I think that can for some people can be not a complete vision of life.
All right, let's take one or two more calls, and then we are out of time. Joe in Long Island, New York, is with us. Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Paul. On Star Trek, they depict people when they're beamed in certain scenes as, like, having a body alteration after that, and then maybe coming back to the original state. And supposedly you got shape-shifting humans, so reports of that. And you have people that want to have body alterations. So I'm wondering if that has any correlation to physics, potentially. And then also with the with us going to the moon, supposedly, why didn't the Russians ever follow suit on that when they were supposedly neck and neck and doing that with us?
Russians gave up. Why'd they do that, Paul? What do you think?
Well, it's a very expensive venture, and in terms of going to the moon, I think we wanted to kind of prove something. I'm not quite sure why the Russians didn't want to spend the money on that, but they were spending money on their military and other things. So maybe once the United States established its priority and established its being first on the moon, maybe it wasn't as much of a motivation. Of course, the Russians came up with the first satellite, the Sputnik, which we just celebrated the 60th anniversary.
Was that 57, wasn't it?
Launch. Yeah. So that was kind of a shock for the Americans to say, wow, all of a sudden the Russians had this shiny ball launched into space.
And it's about the size of a basketball, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. It wasn't really...
Everybody freaked out, though. I was 7 years old when that happened, and I could remember my parents going, oh, my God, they've got this.
So there certainly has been a lot of competition. And back to Wheeler and Feynman, that was something that Wheeler thought about a lot, that, competing with other countries and trying to be patriotic in the sense of trying to make sure that science supports Americans and supports our troops and so forth. That was something that was very much on Wheeler's mind.
What was before the Big Bang?
That's speculation. We really don't know.
We don't know. Do you think, was there anything before the Big Bang?
Well, the speculation is that there was something called the age of inflation, and some people call that the Big Bang. So the Big Bang has become a little bit of an amorphous term because it used to be that it was the beginning of time and the beginning of matter as well. But now we think that most of the matter in the universe, many people believe it was created in this period of ultra-rapid expansion that was a split second, a fraction of a second after the creation of time. So it could be that there was a split second or fraction of a second before this inflationary period, and then we don't know what was before that.
We don't. That's what's so mind-boggling.
Yeah, there's this idea of a bubble universe where there were multiple inflation incidents and that different parts of the universe all of a sudden started expanding outward, so there could be other, that's where the multiverse comes in. There could be other bubbles out there that expanded into whole universes that we just don't know about.
By the way, you're in Philadelphia, so you're coming up on about 3 o'clock in the morning now out there. Are you teaching this morning?
It's a little bit of time travel, isn't it?
It is. Are you teaching this morning?
I'm not teaching this morning.
Okay, so. Good.
So otherwise,
would have been an interesting class, though.
Yeah, I just come in and fall asleep in the middle of class.
Paul, give out your website.
So it's quantumlabyrinth.com for the book, and phalpern.com is my personal website.
Okay, and any new revelations coming up this year? What do you think in the world of physics?
Well, gravitational waves is a big enough revelation. It's been amazing how much progress has been made with gravitational waves.
Backed up Einstein, didn't it?
It did, and it also backed up an idea Feynman speculated about that back in the 50s. And one of Wheeler's students, Joe Weber, was trying to develop gravitational wave detectors for decades. And, of course, Kip Thorne is another of Wheeler's students. So Wheeler and Feynman both would have been very proud to see gravitational waves detected.
All right. Thanks a lot for being on the program, Paul. Really appreciate it. Up next, monsters and creatures. Oh, my.